Coming up today, taxidermy innovation, a growing crisis at Uber, and all the highlights from this year's E3 game show in Los Angeles. You're listening to episode 322 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business and design. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me are Vicky Turk.
Hi.
And Matt Burgess.
Hi.
New issue of Wired magazine is out now. Now, I didn't listen to the podcast last week. Did you big it up?
Yeah,
we did. We bigged it up already. Well, you don't need to know about it then, but you should go and buy it. It's got a fascinating cover feature on the science of success, where we take a look at Ben Ainslie's America's Cup team, even though we know they're already out of the America's Cup.
You didn't listen to the podcast last week?
I didn't, no. I normally do, but I didn't. Was it good?
Oh, it was the best. It was possibly the best one ever.
Well, let's just give up and go home then. No, let's not. Matt Burgess, what did you learn this week?
I'm going to make you guess on this one, but you're, first...
Always.
Let me paint you a picture.
Okay.
Okay, so you've got a room... You've got some wooden planks down the middle of the room. You've placed that go 10 metres in length. So from start to finish, 10 metres. You have got a load of empty beer bottles. You put them down. Good-sized beer bottles, not your 330 mil, the sort of bigger ones, I would say. And you are going to walk across the top of those beer bottles, 1 foot at a time, going across 10 metres. What's the fastest that any human has ever done it?
I knew it was going to be a Guinness World Record. Vicky, you can go first.
I don't even know what the fastest someone could like run 10 metres would be.
Very quick.
Like 10 metres isn't very far at all, is it?
No, but you've got a balance on each bottle. Make sure you don't fall off, smash the bottles, break your feet.
I would say 8 seconds.
I think that's fast. That's got to be 20 seconds.
25.39 seconds.
I had much higher expectations.
Well, it's a fun game that you can try it at home. Please don't. You'll probably end up with shards of glass in your feet. We'll start with our first story, as we always do. No.
Has anybody else learned anything this week?
Good Lord. Yes, I'm getting ahead of myself. Vicky, what did you learn this week?
Oh, so I have some good news this week. Good news for seals. Grey seals, anyway. The grey seal population off the eastern coast of the US has recovered. Massively. So basically in the 70s there were only 30 grey seals observed, and now there are between 30 and 50,000. So,
well, they've been busy.
They have been busy, and it's just a nice little heartwarming win for conservation, and it shows that even when, you know, we push animals right to the brink, if we do actually stop and try to protect them, then sometimes it works.
Caring does make a difference.
Yeah, there you go.
I learned, and this is related to what Vicky's going to be talking about a little later, that the word taxidermy, love a bit of etymology, comes from the Greek word taxis, meaning arrangement, and derma, of course, meaning skin. So it literally means skin arrangement.
Nothing to do with taxis, then?
No. So it makes you wonder, does the word taxi come from the Greek word taxis? Maybe not. Or maybe it does. Right. First story, as unnecessarily teased slightly earlier, Uber. They can't seem to get themselves out of the headlines at the moment, and with good cause or bad cause.
Yeah, and you missed on Vicky's taxi link there that you could have had for this, but...
Oh.
It's 1 week away, James Dempson, and you've just lost that smoothness.
I have, yeah.
But Uber, this week it's released its investigation into working practices and culture at the company, which has come after a long... a fairly long investigation looking at what is going on inside. And there's 13 pages of detailed recommendations from an external lawyer who's looked at the company documents, spoke to loads of people inside about how the company should change itself and basically be better. And one of the biggest things to have happened after this report has been released is Uber's CEO Travis Kalanick has actually stepped down not down from the role, but he's taking an extended period of absence from the company.
It's something to do with to grieve his mother's passing as well, I think.
Yeah, so obviously, tragically, his mother died a few weeks ago, but he has said he's going to step down to grieve her passing. And it comes at the same time that this report is released, which actually says that he shouldn't have as much power as he does.
So it might have been something that would have happened anyway, but obviously tragic personal events for Travis Kalanick means that now there's extra reason for this to happen. But an awful lot more has happened at Uber.
Yeah, so I'm going to give you a little bit of background for people who haven't been keeping up with this story and why there's been a big public investigation and details published about the company and its working practices. So a couple of months ago, I think it was around February, a former employee called Susan Fowler, who was an engineer at the engineer at Uber for about a year or so, after she left the company, she posted a 2,800-word long blog post describing what it was like to be there and how she was treated inside it. And to summarise that, she was basically... There was sexual harassment. There was, when she complained about this sexual harassment, her employers didn't take it seriously. There were sort of threatening messages and sort of things that were really just directed at her and not basically well, the company not dealing with this in the way that you would expect a company to deal with a serious complaint about personal well-being within the workplace.
Well, let's define this sexual harassment, because it's quite important to be specific with these sort of things. So to quote from her blog post, she said of a her manager sending her a string of messages on Uber's company chat system, quote, "He was trying to stay out of trouble at work," he said, "but he couldn't help getting in trouble because he was looking for women to have sex with. It was clear that he was trying to get me to have sex with him, and it was so clearly out of line that I immediately took screenshots." And she goes on, I think, maybe you've included of those chat messages and reported him to HR, but those complaints weren't taken seriously.
No, and that was just one of a number of things that she details in that really long post. And actually, as she spoke to other women within the company who were working there, she found that this was not a particularly uncommon piece of a way that women were treated within the company. So she published this blog post. It got a lot of attention, rightly so. And Uber has tried to respond to this by launching a couple of investigations. One earlier this month saw about 20 people be fired from the company for this sort of behaviour. Not obviously exactly
that's
that behaviour.
That's a lot, isn't it? I mean, that's pretty damning.
It really is. And and then those firings were followed up by this latest report, which is a bit more wide scale, looking at the company overall and how this sort of culture has come to exist in there. Do you want to know some of the things that were said in this report?
So just to pedal backwards, the investigation was carried out by an external law firm, Covington and Burling LLP, and they've been going on for a number of months now. But yes, let's have a look at what the report
said. So this
said.
Is what they suggest Uber should do to try and fix this horrific culture, which has been kind of exposed by Susan Fowler and many other incidents since.
Yes, it is. And Uber has said, or Uber's board has agreed to actually take on all these recommendations, and there are more than the ones I'm going to mention here. They're across 13 pages. You can read them all on our website. But here's a highlight, I guess, of them. So Uber should review and reallocate the responsibilities of Travis. It should use performance reviews to hold senior leaders to account. It should enhance the independence of the board. There should be better HR keeping. Senior team members should have leadership training. Human resources staff should be trained on handling complaints. Managers should get training. Staff who conduct interviews should be trained to do so. Discrimination and harassment policies should be updated. Guidelines about intimate workplace relationships should be developed. And there should be clear guidelines on alcohol consumption. Now, I don't know if it's just me, but these all sound like pretty basic things that any company should have and should be doing anyway.
If you're going to be a company worth in excess of $1 billion potentially that's running city infrastructure inadvertently across the world, then damn right you shouldn't have these kind of things. This isn't some tiny little $2 startup that's just been going for a couple of years. This is one of the biggest companies in the world, and it's, I think everyone has been shocked to find out quite how incompetent Uber is behind the scenes.
Yeah, and actually one of the things that really sums up for me the whole working practices and culture and everything about this report and the whole saga that's been going on at the board meeting where these were being discussed.
You couldn't make this up.
A board member called David Bonderman, who sits on the board because he's an external investor in the company, so he's not necessarily working there day to day, but he made a sexist comment saying if there's more women on the board in future, there'll be more talking, he said.
And then immediately resigned.
And then he resigned.
Well, was kind of pushed to resign with a very sort of, you know, non-apology, saying that, you know, his words came out not as he intended. So I don't know what he was intending. Maybe he was, you know, complimenting women's language abilities or something.
Yes, the verbosity of women on the board. I mean, we're not often super critical on this podcast, but what on earth is going on at this company?
It's, I mean, and you know, I'm sure Uber's not the only one. This is, but that doesn't absolve them at all. Obviously, sexism is something that has been reported in a lot of tech companies, and it is pervasive, and it's something that many women who work in this field have experienced and reported. But yeah, the level here, and as you say, it's all of the different things coming out, and then they manage to botch everything they're trying to do to fix it. You know, this board meeting comment was just the icing on the cake, really. And you might think, oh, it's just an offhand comment, it's a joke that didn't quite go right. But to me, it's just endemic of all of the greater sexism and abuse that's going on. You know, these little offhand comments feed into a broader culture, which means, you know, which could involve women being paid less than their male counterparts, you know, sexual harassment, bullying, all those kind of things.
I mean, can you imagine working at a company where on your first day your manager asks you if you want to have sex with him? That is, it's just absolutely, it's awful. It's a terrible, terrible situation for a company to find itself in. There's a wonderful phrase that sort of sums this all up for me anyway. The fish rots from the head. And there's been an awful lot of criticism of Travis Kalanick and him moving away from the company and the recommendations from the independent review that he has less responsibility and less say, and that he takes stock and thinks very hard about the kind of company he's created and what he wants that company to become. He needs to take some time away, and Uber needs to get itself in order. Matt, also on your notes, you've included some other things that have gone badly for Uber this year, and it's worth going through those as well.
Yeah, so the company has actually had a really terrible year in terms of publicity and its own how it's been perceived, really, and everything that it's been doing has been criticised quite widely. So just for a brief summary, in January, there was the Delete Uber hashtag that spread very widely across the internet after the company was perceived to be trying to profit from protests around Donald Trump's immigration ban. There's been a load of executives leave the company during this year as well. If you go and look online, there's a really long list of senior people that have left for various reasons. One of those has been Anthony Lewandowski, who was the head of the self-driving technologies that they're working on. He left after, in connection to the lawsuit which Google's Waymo company is having against Uber. There's been suggestions of greyballing and investigations from the US central government around this sort of practice of prioritizing and spying on certain people. A lot of these things Uber has sort of denied, some of them it's admitted to, but it's been a very terrible, terrible year for a company that has obviously grown very quickly.
Yes.
But has problems, and has a lot of problems, and hopefully this review will be the sort of first point in where they can take stock and say, we're actually guys, we need to be better.
Yeah.
And not obviously not just guys, like we need to be inclusive as a company, we need to not spy on customers, we need to not spy on competitors, we need to try and do things in a different way.
They need to sort their mess out. There was a story in the New York Times, Fahad Manju published a comment piece saying that everyone needs to think about their use of Uber. And when you look at how toxic the culture at this company is, if you are using Uber, you have it on your phone, as your finger hovers over it to tap and order an Uber, think, do you want to be using that service? And particularly in the United States, where there are alternatives such as Lyft, maybe consider using them instead until Uber can get its mess in order.
Well, this is a thing. I mean, you know, we're saying it's been a really bad year for Uber, and obviously image-wise, and for many Uber employees, it has been. But the company is still, you know, it's still got a lot of customers. It's still functioning. The product is still good. You know, I think we can all agree that it's a useful thing.
And that's the problem. It's a brilliant service. But the best way to make it change is to stop using it. If people stop using it, vote with your feet, vote with your fingers. If you don't like what you're reading about Uber, then have a think. Do you want to keep using the service? Something to ponder. Our second story, bit of a left turn. Taxidermy, Vicky.
Yes, this is a slightly less sort of rage-inducing story. So I went this week to the Grant Museum of Zoology, which is part of UCL in London, because they are undertaking a big repair program to their taxidermy collection. So they've got, I think it's about 75 taxidermy animals, all different kind of animals, and a lot of them are not in great nick. They're, you know, maybe a bit damaged, been handled a bit too much, bit dirty.
Dried, cracking, the stuffing's
falling
out.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, a lot of these are very old. So they're doing a big project at the moment to touch them up, repair them as well as they can, and put them back in the collection so people can enjoy them.
Now, we sort of hinted it at the top of the show, but I thought that taxidermy was an awful lot to do with stuffing, but it turns out that it's very little to do with stuffing.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one. So taxidermy, basically, is about preserving the skin of an animal. So you'd get the skin of the animal, often it would be sent back from somewhere. And the idea is, yeah, to preserve the skin as wholly as you can. And there's kind of two ways you can do it. So they, in the museum's collection, they have some of what's called study skins, which is where you're not really trying to make the animal look like an animal in a natural pose. You're just preserving the skin for study, scientific study. And then you have the ones that people have probably seen. They're quite popular at the moment in pubs and things as well, where, yeah, you try and make the animal look like a realistic animal.
Like a heroic pose.
Exactly. Or just, you know, a natural pose or whatever. There's some quite humorous ones that you can see as well. So, yeah, I mean, in terms of how you actually do that, apparently, it can differ quite a lot. So,
so sometimes it will be you create the skeleton inside. Some of them are stuffed with wood.
You don't create a skeleton. So I spoke to Lucy Mascord, who's a natural history conservator, and she's doing the work at the Grant Museum. And she says, yeah, often you'll start with, like, you know, a metal kind of frame, or build a plaster body to put the skin over. And nowadays, you know, there's much more sophisticated techniques than in the past, when it would be a matter of just, like, stuffing it with whatever was at hand. And she says she has seen some pretty shoddy ones in the past that have had all sorts stuffed in there, from kind of sand to you know, cork or whatever.
The problem was, I mean, some of these I think the oldest they reckon is in excess of 250 years old, and these skins would be sent back from far, far away, and the people that were looking at them had never seen the animal.
Yeah, so this is another issue. So one problem that they've got is a lot of the animals need repair because they're a bit broken. The humidity changes and temperature changes can crack the skin, so you can see the stuffing poking through and that kind of thing. But another problem they have is that some of the taxidermy animals just weren't really that good in the first place. And there's several reasons for that. So one is, yeah, often the skin would be sent back from someone to the taxidermist, and the taxidermist would have never actually seen that animal before. So all they'd have to go on was maybe pictures or a sketch or even just a description. And they'd have to try and sort of piece together the animal skin into what they thought it should look like.
Which is how some of the, I remember, I think the Horniman Museum in south central London has some very early taxidermied lions, and they'd never seen a lion or tiger. No, I think they're lions, and they look like bears. Mm. They've got these really weird bear-like faces, and there's also a walrus that's about four times as big as a walrus should be, because you get kind of this big fleshy sack, and you just keep stuffing it until
exactly.
It feels full.
You don't know how big it's supposed
to be. It's a bleeding big walrus.
You're just inserting like corners into badgers and stuff where there shouldn't be a corner.
Yeah, pretty much.
What was the weirdest one you saw, or any, like, what did you see? What animals were there?
Oh, so they have all sorts. They have a koala, a pangolin, a bunch of duckbill platypuses, some birds, some fish. Some of the amusing ones where they have got kind of errors. One is an echidna, which is sort of it's related to the platypus, apparently, but it's spiny. It looks a bit like a hedgehog. You get them in Australia. And one weird thing about the echidna is its back feet point backwards. But whoever taxidermied this one didn't know this, and so they've actually twisted the feet to point forwards. And so then you've got, you know, cracks all around the ankles because they're not supposed to point that way.
But then they're not changing that.
They're
they
not actually changing
it.
That one. Yeah, so it's a call that the museum has to make when they're doing this conservation. What should they fix, and what is actually a valuable piece of the historical record? And they've decided in the case of the echidna that actually it's quite educational to have the echidna with the feet pointing the wrong way to show, you know, that how conservation has sort of changed over the ages and what methods used to be used.
And our history of animal understanding as well.
Exactly.
So what are some of the processes they're going to be using? I see here that they're using a special vacuum cleaner, but there's some other bits and bobs that they've got lying around.
Yeah. So, I mean, everyone is kind of needs a slightly different thing doing to it. So one thing, a lot of them just need a good clean, really. They're just really dirty. They might have been handled too much. So Lucy was talking me through how she does this. So she uses a mini vacuum cleaner, and it is just like a baby.
This is adorable.
Vacuum cleaner. Yeah, to sort of pick up all the dust and any kind of odd preservatives that were maybe used in the past, which aren't so good for the skin. So that's the first port of call. She said you could Hoover your house with it, but it would take a very long time. Mm-hmm. And then she uses makeup sponges, which are very good apparently for picking off the dirt. And then in a couple of cases, she is going to have to wet wash them, which is, you know, quite tricky, because if you get the actual skin wet, then that can really damage it. That's one of the moisture is one of the things that can cause a lot of damage. So she's going to go in very carefully with some conservation grade detergent on a few of them and give the fur and whatnot a bit of a scrub. A lot of them she's going to put on bases because the animals are just sort of standing on their own feet, which means after a while they start, there's too much pressure and then they can break. And some she's, gluing bits back on. So one sort of mascot at the Grant Museum of Zoology is an owl. And this owl is very well preserved, actually. It's a beautiful specimen, except for it's got these two bright orange eyes, which look more like teddy bear eyes. And they're sort of slightly cross-eyed and they're stuck on. So this owl has a very kind of quizzical expression, which isn't very owl-like.
How disconcerting.
and so they are going to change that one. So Lucy's going to find some better eyes and put them on in the correct positions.
So if there are any youngsters listening to the podcast, study hard at school and you too could be finding the ideal owl eyes for a taxidermied owl and using makeup sponges to clean up 200-year-old echidnas.
There you go.
It's a fascinating job. and you can read a lot more about Vicky's trip to the Grant Museum on wild.co.uk. There's a story there with lots more detail. Third story this week. I'm going to try and race through this as quickly as possible without doing it too quickly. This week was E3, or is E3. This is the annual game hullapalooza in Los Angeles. Wired's Matt Kamen. Kamen. Rhymes with gammon, as he keeps reminding us, is still toiling away at the show as we speak. But all of the big news is already out. The three big games companies, Sony, Microsoft and Nintendo, hold conferences at the beginning of the week, along with EA and Ubisoft and a few others. But the big platform players are the big news. So we're going to focus on them very briefly, platform by platform, starting with Sony, who tried to distract people from the fact that they were mostly showing game trailers, not showing actually any gameplay footage, by having flames, explosions, bodies just writhing around on the stage. So it was a bit of a distraction away from the fact that an awful lot of what Sony was showing, it showed at E3 last year, and there's not an awful lot more to show now. So had a very good E3 in 2016. In 2017, not so much. What was new was VR. So it revealed a VR version of Skyrim, a Final Fantasy spin-off, a new game from Starchild, The Impatient, a psychological horror game, Bravo Team, a military shooter, Mars, a platform where you control a mouse.
Sounds great.
what they didn't show in any of these trailers, which is slightly infuriating, is how VR works with these games. So one of them is a side-scrolling platformer. Well, how does that work in VR? So it remains to be seen, but they've had a lot of success. They've sold more than 1 million units of the PlayStation VR kits, and that's as of June 5th. I don't think anyone expected it to do that well, and it was a bit of a shame that there wasn't more of a focus on it at E3.
Yeah, exactly, and actually I think that the VR stuff from Sony has actually been some of the most impressive gaming VR stuff that we've seen so far. I think that it's actually because of the bundles they've done with the PlayStation 4, it's actually done a lot for VR gaming, probably more in some respects than the higher end headsets that you have to pay to have separate computers with. And really,
yeah, it's a much simpler setup, isn't it? So hats off to Sony, but you should have shown more. You should have made a bigger deal of things at E3. Nintendo's had a very good start to the year with the Nintendo Switch. I don't think anyone expected that to do as well as it has. Didn't really need to show an awful lot to keep the hype going, but it did show Super Mario Odyssey, which is now, we have a confirmed release date of October 27th, and it turns out that it's all about hats, which you already knew a little bit about.
Hats. The things you wear on your head.
Yes, so everyone knows Mario wears a hat with the M on it. That's sort of one of Mario's trademark things. He wears dungarees, he wears a hat, and he has a mustache.
I can't remember him wearing a hat.
Oh, man, gorgeous. You played enough Super Mario Run to know he wears a hat.
Oh, it's a flat cap. I was thinking it more is. Of a bowler hat.
No,
yeah, he didn't. Like I don't remember that. You know, like a baseball cap. Yeah.
Like a plumber's hat.
Yeah, you know. Traditional plumber's hat.
Yeah, everyone's Italian plumber wears a hat. So the newly sentient Mario hat can be chucked at pretty much anything. So if you throw it at a fire hydrant, you can use that fire hydrant as a weird spring to fling yourself around. If you throw it at a rocket, then you blast off into the clouds. If you throw it at a dinosaur, you control a dinosaur or a tank or a bullet bill. So it's this whole new gameplay mechanic for Mario, which is remarkable that Nintendo's still coming up with new ways to radically change this game that's more than 20 years old now, I think.
This sounds great, I have to say. I'm really looking forward to this one. I've been enjoying playing on the Switch, and this sounds like a fantastic new game for me.
Yeah,
I've always loved the Mario franchise.
It's a return to Super Mario Galaxy, which we last saw on the Wii. Everyone was hoping that there'd be a big open world Mario game for the Wii U, but Nintendo instead focused on multiplayer Mario games, which were fun, but slightly different. So this is a return to the big worlds, the kingdoms, and all of that jazz. So it's very exciting.
It's a new way to think about hats as well.
Yeah, a whole new way to think about hats. And as someone pointed out on Twitter, well, for all these years, we thought that Mario was wearing a hat, but it turns out that the hat is actually wearing Mario, and he's been enslaved by this hat, which is terrifying.
I don't think I really want to think about it that way.
The hat has eyes. It winks at you. It's
might
weird.
Be a bit deep for...
Oh, it is deep. Let's not get too deep now. Elsewhere, as I said, Nintendo didn't really show very much. Metroid Prime 4, which is the first Metroid game for about a decade, is in development for the Switch. That's all we know about it. Yoshi and Kirby games for Switch, side-scrolling cutesy platformers, of which I'm a big fan, are coming out in 2018. There's going to be a Switch version of Rocket League, which is in the works, and there'll be cross-platform multiplayer and some exclusive Nintendo bits and bobs, including a Mario hat. That's coming out towards the end of 2017. And not satisfied with one Pokemon game for Switch, the console is also getting a new Pokemon RPG, trying to speak too quickly, developed by Game Freak, but that's all we know about that for now.
I'm so excited about all of these, I have to say.
It's looking good for Nintendo.
I just really like these kind of things. I've never been one for, you know, first-person shooters or, like, war games or anything like this. And, yeah, I mean, I guess a lot of people think these are more kind of child-oriented or child-friendly, but I love these kind of exploration challenges, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and Nintendo is looking increasingly different compared to its other platform competitors in pursuing this multiplayer, more accessible, less blood-stained form of gaming, which moves us seamlessly on to Microsoft. Vicky, if you don't like guns, then look away now.
It's not the one for me.
No. Microsoft's Project Scorpio, which you knew an awful lot about already, but it now has a name, the Xbox One X, which is a lot of X's. Too many, some might say.
Does it read the same backwards? No, it doesn't.
It would be the Xeno X or Box.
Or the X1 Box X.
Or the Xeno X Zob X. Anyway, it will launch on November 7th. So we didn't know that. We didn't know the release date. We didn't know the name. What we also didn't know is what it would look like. Turns out it looks like an Xbox. But it's going to be a lot smaller. So probably this is the smallest Xbox branded console ever. So it looks remarkable. And considering that it's supremely powerful, that Microsoft managed to squeeze that much into such a small chassis is very impressive. Also means it has to be liquid cooled to stop it from setting on fire. Microsoft lost its way a bit since the Xbox 360, which was much loved, but then it sort of got a bit confused by trying to persuade people that an Xbox should be your media hub and you should be watching all your telly on it and doing all these sort of things. So it stepped back a bit from that, and it's doing what it does best, which is going after hardcore gamers. So with that in mind, Microsoft announced 42 games are in development for its new system, 22 of which will form some sort of Xbox exclusivity.
And now you're going to read them all out.
I am, starting with, no. You can find out an awful lot more about them on wider.co.uk, of course, or just have a bit of a Google around. The Xbox One X will cost $499 in the United States and £449 in the UK. Chuck in an extra controller, a couple of games, and anything else you might want to get for it, and you're looking at more than £600, which is quite a lot to spend on a new console.
That is quite a lot. And so you were saying one of its selling points is how small it is. How small is it? Is it sort of... Because obviously the Switch you can use as a console with your TV, and that's really small.
Yeah, if you imagine an echidna, with its feet pointing the wrong way. Well, put those feet the right way. I'm not sure how big it is exactly off the top of my head, but it's noticeably smaller. I mean, the Xbox One S is a fairly sizable piece of hardware.
It's a bit of a beast.
So it won't be as small as the Switch, but it won't be as hulkingly big as Xboxes that we've come to know and love. The major selling points of this console, of course, are 4K and backwards compatibility. So this is the big selling point for Microsoft. It's 4K compatible. How many people here have a 4K TV? Put your hand up in the air nice and high. No one has put their hands up in the air. I can imagine if I did the same thing on the streets or in this office where we're fairly tech savvy, not a lot of people would. I'm not sure if it differs in the States, but it's a big thing to go after when no one owns the things.
I've still got a HD ready TV, not even HD.
It's ready, but it's not quite there yet.
For about 10 years.
Yeah. So it's going after 4K, but for me the biggest feature is backwards compatibility. So it's compatible with all the old Xbox One software and hardware. That's 6 years of old games that you can keep on playing. And if, like me, you're quite a slow gamer, you enjoy gaming, but you don't do it all the time, well, companies releasing a new console once every couple of years, you're like, well, I haven't played all the games on the old one yet, and then you have to put it away and get it out again and plug it all in. So having a console that doesn't ditch all the old games, and some of them will look better on this one as well, is really good news for me not having to stuff more consoles under my sofa and get them out and try and work out how to make them work and hope that they haven't died in the interim.
I mean, that is great news, but I do kind of feel like that should be standard. Come on.
Yes.
I mean, I know it's not, but...
No, yeah. It's very much not. And it's become easier now that everyone has super fast internet connections, so you don't have the problem of, well, you've got to run the disk and you've got to make up some sort of way of emulating the hardware. Well, now it's a bit easier. You can do it all digitally. So we're definitely moving towards that future, and hopefully this is now a thing of the past. So to summarise, what's hot? Nintendo, 4K, the letter X, and trailers that don't show any gameplay footage. What's not? Guns, sequels, and trailers that don't show any gameplay footage. You can read an awful lot more of Wired's E3 2017 coverage, typed out by the sweating, bleeding hands of Matt Kamen, on Wired.co.uk. We will finish with a quiz.
Oh, no.
I didn't know this was coming.
Yes. Yeah, well, I did put quiz on the notes.
It's just I haven't
put down the answers yet. So, fingers on imaginary buzzers. Actually, Matt Burgess, if you were a buzzer, what noise would you make?
I think I'd be pretty standard as a buzzer. Just, eh.
Okay. Vicky?
Maybe that was it.
Just silence. Okay, if you hear the noise, that's Matt Burgess. If you hear silence, which is always fun on a podcast, then Vicky's about to answer. Okay, so in the week that Facebook finally added a GIF button, thank the Lord for the GIF button, a quiz about GIFs.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I know. How good's your GIF knowledge?
I'm going to say solid 10 out of 10.
10 out of 10? Well, there's only 5, so...
I like GIFs, but I'm not sure I have much knowledge about them.
I've got a favourite GIF, so it's...
According to the 1967 Encoding Agreement Act of the... No. In what year was the GIF invented? Yes, Matt Burgess.
It was 30 years ago.
Okay. Go on.
Doing maths on the top of my head, which should be very easy, should be 1987.
That's brilliant maths. And it is. You're right. It was developed by US-based software writer Steve Wilhite while working at the bulletin board service provider CompuServe.
Can I just say, have we discussed GIF versus GIF?
We're just about to get onto it.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So, how is it pronounced? How is it pronounced?
So, I feel like, and I may be completely wrong, but I feel like originally, what's his name? The guy who invented it.
Steve
intended it to be pronounced GIF, but I would argue that at least now it is solidly in the lexicon as GIF. No one says GIF.
Yes. So when it was being developed at CompuServe, it was named after the American peanut butter brand, GIF. So according to Steve, you should say it like gin. So it's GIF, the soft G of gin. not the hard G of
What does the Godzilla. Dictionary say? Because I feel like, you know how language evolves over time.
It's
definitely GIF, come on.
It's GIF. He's lost ownership of the term. But originally it was named after the peanut butter brand Jif.
Why was it named after a peanut butter brand?
It was something to do with the slogan of Jif at the time, and they made this joke that Jif and GIF, Jif was, I don't know, look it up. It's on Wikipedia, I'm sure. According to Steve, what was the first ever GIF?
Was that your buzzer sound?
That was a sigh. I'll guess it involved something to do with cats.
Oh, I was going to guess cats. I'm going to go for something different then. I'm going to say it was the turning on of a computer. Just like a light coming on. That's a terrible, terrible GIF.
No, it was a plane.
A plane?
It was a plane. Although he's not quite sure because he says it was a long time ago. So no one got that. No points. It's one all. I am keeping score. Number four. How many colours can each frame of a GIF use? Yes.
Why am I still doing that?
Matt Burgess.
128.
No.
Is this like a trick question?
Matt Burgess was close in a way.
28.
No. Would you like another guess, Matt? Because I think you get it.
256.
Yes, it's 256.
Oh, I was way off.
And the reason, when it was invented, not much hardware was capable of showing more colours simultaneously. So 256 was seen as enough. So Matt Burgess runs, races into the lead, 2-1. Question five. Founded in 2013, online GIF repository Giphy serves how many GIFs per day?
350 million.
You didn't make your buzzer noise.
It's not
350 million.
Lower or higher?
Well, no. And plus, if you get it right, we'll have a tie, and I don't have a tiebreaker, so this can't possibly happen.
10 million.
No.
Is it way less?
It's way more.
Way more?
Yes.
I was kind of thinking, I overthought this one. I thought, loads of people use multiple GIFs every day. There's loads of people with access to the internet. It must be loads. And then I was like, no, I'm in a media bubble where we all use GIFs all the time. Normal people don't use GIFs.
Mm.
But I was wrong.
Yeah, I mean, Matt Burgess's GIF use on an average day is probably in the hundreds. So you've got to account for people like that.
A billion.
Yes, it is 1 billion, which means
yes,
that everyone wins. Congratulations, everyone. In October 2016, Giphy was serving over 1 billion GIFs per day. Visitors were watching more than 2 million hours of GIF content every day. And that's 100 million daily active users of Giphy.
Wow, GIFs are big business.
GIFs are big business, it turns out. And in fact, you can find out how GIFs are big business with our profile of Giphy, which is on wired.co.uk. Roland interviewed the founder a few months ago. We'll leave it there. Thank you very much. Excellent quizzing. I'll try and come up with one that's equally as fun next week. We'll see you again then. Bye-bye.
Bye.